My name is Ernst Christoph Friedrich Sandel. I was born in Germany in 1939. I immigrated to Canada in 1958. And in 1968, I decided to declare myself an official candidate of the Liberal Party for the post of leader of the Liberal Party. Because the Liberal Party in 1968 also was the governing party, whoever became leader of the Liberal Party and replaced the then retiring leader of the Liberal Party, Lester Pearson, became automatically the Prime Minister of Canada. This was a unique political constellation which I decided to exploit for my own purposes, namely to run for the post of leadership and Prime Minister of Canada, and at the same time to get the ear of the Canadian public for a grievance which I, as a German Canadian immigrant, felt was not being dealt with properly by Canadian government circles. Here you have some of the interviews and some of my main speeches following.
I'm looking to speak to Mr. Ernst Sandel of the Canadian Unity Movement.
Speaking.
My name is James Alexander. I'm with the BSN News Service.
Mm-hmm.
I have received your press release in the mail regarding running for the Prime Minister of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask you a few questions, seeing that you are what I might say is an unusual candidate.
Oh, thanks you for the compliment.
Okay. Now, you're the leader of the Canadian Unity Movement?
The director.
The director of the Canadian Unity Movement. Now, you are here, in fact, actually running for the leader of the Liberal Party.
Yes.
Well, what difference is between the Liberal Party of Canada, which you want to run for leader of, and the organization which is called the Canadian Unity Movement?
A political party is always really only a means to a specific end. Every political party in the world, by necessity, is divisive and not unifying. A political party usually expresses or reflects the wishes of a number of people which have come together for an ideological reasons. For instance, in South Africa we have the apartheid party of the Boers. In England we have the Labour Party, which is socialist. In Canada we have the Liberal Party, which is liberal, the Conservative Party, which is conservative, and the New Democratic Party, which is a quasi-socialist or social democratic party in the European sense. So a movement like the Canadian Unity Movement is trying to speak to Canadian liberals, progressives, socialists, conservatives, and so on. In other words, it'll be some organization that is beyond the political in delineation.
I see. Now, I wonder if you could explain to me something here. From the name, the Canadian Unity Movement, I would suspect that you may be anti-separatist or against the separation plan for some people in Quebec.
Certainly, one of the reasons, possibly the chief reason, why I am entering public life is to oppose the threat of separatism, which I find virulent and not combated by the rest of Canada. Maybe the country is too vast, and we who live in Montreal and its suburbs and are subjected to all the slights, the agitation, the bomb exploding, the demonstrations and so on by these very vocal separatist elements feel more In other words, we are almost like in the olden days of the United States, when those who were in the garrisons in the Old West were far more keenly attuned to the Indian problems than those who sat in the offices in Washington.
Well, what would you do if you were the leader of this nation and one province voted on the whole that they wish to separate?
I would never let it get to the point of a breakup, because I, my cabinet, every member of my party would be in that province actively agitating for national unity against separatism. And I would run the government of Canada in such a way and in such a fashion and with such even-handedness that there wouldn't be one segment of the Canadian population that would have to feel out of the mainstream of Canada. In other words, it is a question which under my leadership would never arise. I would combat it, I would nip it through positive action on the grassroots level. I would isolate the crackpots, the separatists, and one thing needs to be mentioned here. The most dangerous separatists are those who don't proclaim or declare themselves separatists. They are Marxist infiltrators with a long history of pro-communist, pro-Marxist causes and committee affiliations and so on.
Okay, Mr. Zeno, let's hear a little bit about your background. Now, you're 29 years old and you're an immigrant. How long have you been in Canada?
Been in Canada since 1958.
1958. Mm-hmm. Now, from reading some of your literature here, I can't really tell whether you're pro-immigration or against it. I wonder if you could specify on this subject.
Number one, being an immigrant myself, I'm naturally pro-immigrant. It would be kind of a split personality if I wasn't. I feel very strongly that the immigrants in Canadian society have never had an equal voice. We had an equal share in paying our taxes, and during war times, I'm quite sure that immigrants to Canada actually did fight for the country on equal terms, but we never had an equal voice in national affairs, and I think now is a crucial time for the immigrants to come to the fore to be the tip on the scale in favor of national unity. We are not French, we have no gripes against the English, we are not English, we have no gripes against the French. We are possibly the only true Canadian force in this country.
Well, Mr. Zendel, of course, no one should interfere with your right to run as the Prime Minister of this country or leader of any political party you choose. But as an immigrant who has only lived here for a third of your life, why do you think that you could be a better leader of this nation, which you wouldn't have been here long enough to really understand all the problems?
Reminds me of the story of the salesman that I have read somewhere. He said, walking into his boss's office and saying to him, "Sir, I have been with your company for the last 30 years and I have 30 years experience. I deserve a raise." And the boss looked at him quizzically and he said, "Sit down, Joe. I want to tell you something about your 30 years experience. You have been with this company for 30 years, it's true, but you have had exactly 1 year of experience repeated 30 times. If I look at the way Canadian politicians of both ethnic groups, how they act, the proposals that they propose for Canada, believe me, the Canadian political business is made up of people with 1 year's political experience repeated 30 times.
And you expect that you could do a much better job?
Much better. I'm an artist. Artists by nature, by temperament, are creative people. We have far too many lawyers in Canadian government and in the Canadian political system. What we need to get away from is the precedent, ever over the shoulder, backward looking, dusty book collectors operating only by precedent. We need creative solutions to problems which crop up on a daily basis. I intend to be a moderator. I'm married to a French Canadian. I have lived amongst English Canadians. I'm living amongst French Canadians. I'm perfectly trilingual, and I think that this qualifies me as well as the next man. Furthermore, I think that this is a canard and a sign of prejudice that English Canadians and French Canadians heave at us immigrants, that we are not supposed to have any solutions. We have brains, we have souls, We have minds, and we have obviously equally as good solutions. Most likely, we have better solutions to the Canadian problem.
Okay. Now, under your platform here, you have a section on constitution. Are you against the monarchy?
I'm neither for nor against, really. It leaves me cold. However, once again, I look at this from the viewpoint of the majority population in Canada, which is no longer English Canadian. What we have is an English monarchy, a relic from the colonial days. I have no axe to grind against Her Majesty the Queen. I think she does a lovely job. She represents her country well. However, I frankly think that in this year of 1968, we should get on with the task of creating a Canada by Canadians, for Canadians, and giving Canadian solutions and Canadian representation, and not have the Queen, what I consider, of England representing Canadians abroad.
Okay, now you mentioned here that you would let the people decide by referendum whether to retain or reject the monarchy. Is that right?
I think that's eminently democratic. It's the only solution to this thorny issue. It would mean that by referendum, people would not be bound by political parties and ideological considerations. They could actually vote with their mind and with their hearts. And only politicians who are afraid of the voice of the people would be afraid to grant the people a referendum on such a topic.
Would you keep your government out of the referendum, just present both sides?
Most definitely. I think that I would certainly not campaign in favor of one or another, and I would implore all the other leaders of all the other political parties to let the people of Canada make a choice based on what is within them, not some political brainwashing or whatever takes place when we go on electioneering campaigns.
Well, I can't understand why you wouldn't let the people of one province then decide what is in their hearts if they wish to separate from Canada. And you mentioned that you would actively campaign against this.
The people in Canada who are separatists, 99.9% of them, are actually agents, whether they know it or not, of a foreign ideology, of a foreign power, namely Marxism. I have lived in this province for 8 years. I'm married to a French Canadian. I'm going to a university in the city of Montreal. I can assure you, all the people that I have seen agitate and speechify and promote and propagand are all well-known, almost threadbare leftists and Marxists. The country as a whole doesn't know about that because there are too many commies and communists and communist sympathizers in the media and on high government levels.
Okay, well, let's get into another topic here. In your literature, you mentioned you would settle strikes in a different manner. Now, talking about strikes of the essential services, like the post office and the transportation, holding up the government for ransom. Now, isn't it the people's right, if they wish to strike, that they can go ahead and do this?
No, I don't. I think that the strike is, again, like the monarchy, a tool of a bygone age. This is the age of instant communication and global communication. We could settle these problems, if they were negotiated properly and fairly, on a very humane basis. If the governments of this country and of the Western world were not afraid to govern, and if they were truly leading, and if they had the qualities of leadership that they claim they have, the fact is that you no longer need to go on a strike to make your grievances heard.
Well, Mr. Zindel, how would you, as a Prime Minister of Canada, settle a strike, say, between the postal workers and the government, if both sides can't come to an agreement?
I would immediately remove the right to strike from all what they have now, unions in the public sector. And at the same time, I would remove the right to strike from all sectors of Canadian society. I believe that what we can institute is a permanent body of arbitration that can be composed and recomposed as the need arises any particular time by people of a segment of the population, from the judiciary, from religious leaders, the media and so on, as the need and as the area of industry, commerce or so on requires. I do not think that, again, the communists in the Canadian postal system, and every time there is a meeting of Canadian postal workers, those few communist, trained communist and leftist union leaders that salute the press with clenched fists, I ask you, they are the people that are intimidating the regular postal worker. Our problems are not the thousands and thousands of members of the postal unions. Our problems are communist infiltrated troublemakers.
Okay, Mr. Zendel, I've got one last question, and it's regarding a paragraph here which you devote entirely to what you say is anti-German propaganda in with regard to Canadian unity. Do you, as a German immigrant, really believe that we have anti-German propaganda broadcast night after night on our television screens?
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. You see, that you as a young man in Canada don't recognize that is symptomatic. In other words, you have grown up in this environment of hate that it has become part of your outlook. You're no longer sensitive to it. I suppose I can only compare it to those who grew up in the deep south during the era of slavery. To them, slavery seemed natural because that's all they knew. To Canadians, anti-German propaganda, anti-German programs where the Germans are made like idiots, goose-stepping, bums, raping nuns, whipping children, shoving Jews into gas ovens and stuff like that, has become part of the Canadian psyche. I find it terrible. I find it obscene. If you were to sensitize yourself to the feeling of a very large minority, namely the German Canadians, you would find out that we are grossly discriminated against, that we are daily slandered and vilified. It doesn't stop at movies. It is in radio programs, in my textbooks at university now. We are being taught about the rape of Czechoslovakia. You know, rape in politics doesn't exist because there's nobody to rape. There might be such a thing as invasions and so on, but it is this emotional propaganda that I object to most strenuously.
Mr. Zindel, are you actually denying that these atrocities committed by the Germans during the Second World War actually happened?
Bunk. Absolute bunk. Absolute bunk.
You mentioned that you're being taught this in university. You know, isn't that proof enough?
Our university textbooks are largely written by people who have an axe to grind, namely Jewish authors who write these textbooks for profit. And unfortunately, Canadians, as I said to Weir once before, are not alert to the fact. And it is interesting, I consider it also a deflection maneuver by Canadian educators, by the Canadian establishment, and by acquiescence by the Canadian people to point away from their own war crimes, which were many, and which we Germans did suffer. After all, no German soldiers set foot on Canadian soil, but Canadian soldiers twice traveled far across the sea, 5,000 miles, to get to Europe and to bomb and to beat and to shoot the living daylights out of my people. We sent to this country only hard-working craftsmen, pioneers, peasants, soldiers to protect you from the United States in the War of Independence and in the War of 1812, and in exchange the Germans daily and in the history books for the last 50, 60 years get kicked into the teeth.
Well, Mr. Zendel, I'd like to thank you very much on behalf of BSN News Service for this interview. It's very interesting and informative interview.
Thank you.
And you'll be hearing from us again.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye. Bye-bye.
Hello.
Hello. Mr. Zendel?
Yeah, speaking.
Am I correct on the pronunciation of that name?
Yes.
Well, this is Joe Morris. I'm calling from California.
Oh my God. All the way from the sunny state, eh?
Yes. Well, it's raining out here now. I'm a WAR representative of the University of California Press. And we have a teletype service, and I'm a specialist in international relations and foreign affairs, and it's come to our attention that you're running for Prime Minister of Canada.
You mean all the way out there, you heard that? Terrific.
You seem to represent some kind of a new wave, as the wire service report here says.
Well, that's nice.
So we're interested in hearing some of your new ideas.
Well, okay, fire away. What, since you are in the foreign affairs, would you rather have me stick to that topic, or what would you like to know?
Well, I'm have to admit some ignorance about Canadian domestic affairs, but we would be interested in knowing just what you would do if you became Prime Minister about changing Canada's role in certain areas of international affairs.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything specific in mind?
Well, let's say the United Nations.
Well, as you know, Canada has got a long and what the media likes to call friendly relationship and a positive relationship with the United Nations. Canada takes great pride in having supplied peacekeeping troops to all kinds of areas of the globe where the United Nations has gotten involved. And you start out with a very difficult question for me, because the United Nations is one of my sore spots. I'll tell you, quite frankly and absolutely honestly, my gut feeling towards the United Nations is one of standoffishness.
You don't think the United Nations is our only hope for world peace?
I don't think that an international organization comprised of imperfect systems of government, mainly plutocracies, authoritarian governments, communist dictatorships, petty dictatorships, military dictatorships. In other words, I do not think that a collection of moral cripples will make a spiritual gladiator. So my stand on the United Nations is that I would examine each issue very carefully, and certainly far more be inclined to make Canadian interests come first. I certainly wouldn't present lavish presents on the United Nations, because frankly, I think that the United Nations is basically a collection of international KGB agents, Marxists, neutralists posing, Marxists posing as neutralists, a motley crew. No, I'm afraid if this is what causes the term that I'm representing a new wave on the United Nations, yeah, I represent the new wave. I would very, very carefully examine every dollar, every cent that, if I ever become Prime Minister of Canada, that would go to that organization.
Well, I certainly don't agree with you there, Mr. Sundell. I'm more of the opinion that regardless of their differences, the United Nations offers all these different people a chance to get together, and if they can get together and talk, as long as they keep talking, they won't be fighting.
Yeah, I had heard that claim made. In the meantime, we have had 50 wars. We have a hot war going on in one part of the world where daily thousands and thousands of innocent people are being killed in bombing raids and so on, and the United Nations obviously is powerless to stop it. Why is it powerless to stop it if it's such a wonderful organization?
Well, let's point out a specific area here. In Vietnam, for example.
That's the one I'm referring to. The United States, which is also a member of the Security Council, is engaged in a shooting war in Asia, has been engaged in a shooting war, is conducting what some people call genocide against people, because after all, what they do is they kill everything that walks around in blue in black pajamas and count the bodies at night. And it's a glorified form of counting Indian scalps. Has the United Nations been able to stop anything in that? No. Nothing at all. The United States is a member of the United Nations. Is anybody stopping the United States? No.
Well, surely through mutual agreement in the Security Council, they've been able to stop the spread of the Vietnam War.
That's nice. In other words, we haven't been able to stop the killing, but we have stopped the spread of this war. It's a question that you're posing to me. Have you ever stopped beating your wife?
Well, no organization is perfect. And unfortunately, the United Nations is imperfect, largely because it doesn't have the wholehearted support of all the members. But I think that if we could get a genuine world government that had a world peacekeeping force under the UN auspices, we could eliminate areas of conflict like Vietnam and these and other places.
And who would prevent those nations that veto it in the Security Council from being policed? Would the Soviet Union ever allow United Nations troops on its territory? Forget it. It's a pipe dream.
It's a pipe dream that millions of people are pursuing, and I hope for one that they continue to pursue it.
There is such a thing as mass hallucination.
Well, Mr. Zundel, I'm afraid you sound like some kind of elitist. Won't go so far as to say a fascist, but the UN is clearly the majority will, and you seem to be going clearly against the majority's will.
Have you ever gone to a public park, and have you ever seen a monument to a committee? I've never seen one. It's always monuments to great men committing great deeds and achieving great feats.
Well, that's the heroic theory of history, and I don't support that at all.
Well, it is the only history that has ever been recorded, because I don't remember the lumpen proletariat of Alexander the Great's day, but I certainly remember Alexander the Great. I don't remember the lumpen proletariat in some slave agitator in Caesar's day, but I certainly remember Caesar.
Well, maybe that was because they had special media coverage in those days.
Beautiful.
But
you're joking, of course.
Well, we don't know who writes history, that far, but...
Anyways, as to the United Nations getting involved in Vietnam, forget it. I ask myself the question why the United States is over there in the first place. And I certainly have examined the role of Canada in this particular fight over there. I think it's an unsavory one. I think that if I was Prime Minister of Canada, I would certainly pull Canada out of what they call International Control Commission, because it is useless. It is being manipulated by our big, powerful neighbor to the south. And since we are dependent on the United States and controlled by the United States, it is a mockery. And if these people in Asia and the Third World accuse us of complicity with the United States, I certainly think they are right. I think, if you want my absolute honest opinion about this Vietnam War, I have said that at the university where I'm presently studying. I've said it in newspaper columns. I've said it in open line shows and in interview shows in Canada. The United States is, in effect, fighting a war against Red China.
What?
Exactly. And they are fighting a war for the Soviet Union, against Red China. American boys, American treasure, American military hardware is being used to try to bully Red China back into Moscow's fold. Now, this might
that
be...
That is far out. That is really far out.
It is possibly far out, but I'll make a suggestion to you. And since you claim to be an expert in international relations, I ask you to look at these components. Look, we have a nation called the United States claiming to be engaged in an anti-communist war 10, 15,000 miles away from home, 90 miles off the shore of the United States. In Cuba, there is another communist state. The United States has a military base right on Cuba called Guantanamo Base. The United States could wipe out Cuba within 24 hours because they could fly from Florida and could march from Guantanamo Base and remove this communist cancer in the Western Hemisphere. The United States is not doing it. On the contrary, the United States is supplying the communist dictator of Cuba with millions and millions of dollars of foreign exchange, because they are buying refugees. They are back in the slave trade. This time it's the human slave trade, people, political prisoners, and so on. Now, if the United States were so interested in fighting communism, I suggest they should fight someplace where they could win. Why go 10, 12, 15,000 miles away from home and fight for allegedly the freedom of a people which have nothing in common with the people of the United States. They have no system of democratic government. The people of Southeast Asia are barely out of the Stone Age. Now, what the hell are we doing over there, shipping our troops 12,000 miles across the seas in a jungle war? The great American general, General Douglas MacArthur, has warned we should never ever again get involved in. I believe it is a war by the United States militarists, by the United States capitalists, to make money, to drive the United, the Red China, back into the arms of Russia.
Well, that's a kind of domino theory in reverse. But you seem to indicate that the United States couldn't win in Vietnam.
After the United States, I think it was Lenitzer who said, we should bomb them back in the Stone Age. The United States could so devastate Vietnam that they could wipe every man, woman, fly, and worm off China's map, and of Southeast Asia's map. Of course they could win it, but all the rhetoric, all the moves are in such a way that the soldiers are allowed only to die, but not to have victory, not to win.
Well, do you think that if you... United States increases the number of troops that it has, goes from the advisor stage into an ally military presence that
makes no difference whatsoever. Not in my mind. It is an immoral, unrealistic thing. I do not believe in it. I think it is a conspiracy by the United States establishment, and in combination with the Soviet Union's establishment, a very cleverly, diabolically evil conspiracy to drive the people of Red China, which are showing signs of independence, back into the arms of the Soviet Union.
Well, you seem to disagree then with most political observers on the scene that observe an alliance, a strong alliance between Red China and the Soviet Union.
The alliance between the Soviet Union and Red China was broken almost 10 years ago and only exists today in papers and in the heads of such mental cripples as your John Birch Society.
Well, I'll agree with you there about the John Birch Society.
Now look, just as an afterthought, I want to add one more component to this thing so it doesn't look like a wild theory. You have Taiwan, which is an American satellite, totally dependent on American arms, American money, American export markets, and so on.
That's right.
No. I think it's the Pacific Fleet, or the 7th Fleet, or whatever fleet it is, that the United States has patrolling in the China Seas.
Yes.
What is it there for? It is there for, explicitly and ostensibly, to keep the Taiwan government from invading China. You see? No. What we're doing is, on the one hand, we are keeping this bully called Taiwan on a leash, constantly threatening the Chinese with it unless they move back into the Soviet circle.
Well, the official announcements, of course, have the U.S. fleet as defending Taiwan against the Red Chinese.
China never made any moves except lobbing a couple of artillery shells or a couple of thousand artillery shells across to Quemoy. If I was a communist, I would say that Taiwan is the mad dog kept at the American leash, ready to pounce on China, if China will not buckle down to this international conspiracy. I really do believe that. Now, you ask me, have I unusual ideas?
Wow.
Maybe these are unusual ideas.
Well, they certainly are, and it will take me quite a while to assimilate them.
Look, I'd be happy to send you, I published a small pamphlet, a kind of synopsis of this, that appeared in my column in the Sir George Williams newspaper. It's called America's Race Against Time, and all the maps, statistics, facts, and figures are in there.
Well, I'd certainly appreciate it.
I'll send one to you.
Well, thank you. One other thing, moving on here, we certainly covered some of the hottest parts of the world. What is your opinion regarding Red China, then? How would it influence your role as Prime Minister of Canada?
Now, I want to tell you that I am a dyed-in-the-wool anti-communist, anti-Marxist, that I'm a free enterpriser, and that I'm a nationalist. So, Just, I want to preface my remarks with that. However...
Excuse me, you do sound a little bit like a fascist.
Yeah, you know, the old fascist label. I figured sooner or later you were going to bring that to me. Coming from your kind of university, I'm not surprised. I'm not a fascist. I have never joined the fascist movement, but I'm an independent thinking man. If these are the only people today in the world, well, then I suppose I'm a fascist. But to come back to your question, I would certainly be in favor that the Western world recognizes Red China as the legitimate government of China. Furthermore, I would support China with our Western technology, both military and civilian technology, and I would certainly be in favor of cultural exchanges with the People's Republic of China, and I would certainly, if I was certainly in Western Europe, very strongly recommend that the people of Western Europe use Red China as a counterweight against the Soviet Union.
You don't think that would maybe lead to World War III, do you?
I don't think that we're going to have a World War III very soon, for the very reason that the Marxists already control so much of the Western world, and they certainly control the Eastern world, that they can get by stealth, subversion, infiltration, far more. They can get the whole Western world intact rather than destroying it by bombs. So I think that this is a Marxist bogey.
Bogeyman. The old conspiracy theory again of history.
Well, be that as it may, conspiracies certainly do happen, and many of them have been exposed, and all the signs, in my opinion anyways, point towards a massive conspiracy. And if Communist China today says that the Soviet Union are the new Tsarists, and that the United States and the Soviet Union are in cahoots with one another to divide up the world, I believe that they do.
You think then that detente actually exists between the Soviet Union and the United States?
I don't think that detente exists. I think that collaboration exists.
Collaboration, that's a nasty sounding word. I still don't agree with you. I think that the capitalist powers have basic contradictions with the communist bloc countries, and I think that the socialists don't have it as easy as you seem to think, that they're able to take over the entire Western world, holding your hat out underneath the ripe fruit tree and letting it fall in.
If I may be so rude and interrupt right here, look, every time the communist system was on the brink of bankruptcy, tottering, internal revolution, military defeat, it is the Western world, principally and chiefly the two biggest capitalist powers, namely England with its empire and America with its financial global globe-girdling empire, that came to its rescue. In 1941, when German troops, and since I'm a German, I remember our history very well, had actually beaten the Soviet Union to the ground and were fighting outside Moscow, 10 kilometers outside Moscow, it was the might of the United States and the influence of the British Empire that saved the system then. We had it time and again. We had it in the Hungarian Revolution. We had it every time that the Soviet Union was in trouble, the West came to its rescue.
Well, after all, the Nazis were the worst threat to world peace. Even the capitalists thought they were too much.
Well, they're certainly
too far out.
They certainly were a threat to the capitalists as well as to the communists, because they no longer thought in those outmoded class war concepts. You're right.
Well, don't you think that, as Lenin said, the capitalists are out of blind greed, selling the Soviet bloc the rope with which to hang them? Don't you think it's just a matter of blind greed? Capitalists behaving like capitalists.
Plays a great part in it, yes. I must say.
Points to a collaboration.
I must say that you did study your Marxist textbooks well down there at the University of California.
Well, that's we are a progressive school over here.
Oh, there is that word progressive again.
But
know, all this aside, I just don't see that there is that degree of coordination between the Soviet bloc and the Western capitalist.
Well, I can give you another proof.
Yeah, what?
In Berlin, when this infamous wall was put up, President Kennedy, who came over 1 year after the war was put up, sat in his rocking chair in the White House, acquiescing to the takeover, well, to the cementing of this infamous wall that separates Europe, knowing full well from his Secret Service and the CIA intelligence that the Russian and the East German troops that were guarding the workmen as they were putting up this wall had only one bullet in their guns, one bullet only, and that behind them were Russian tanks who were under strict orders to let the building of this wall proceed because the United States is not going to do one thing. In other words, the United States had signaled through its representatives in Vienna that they were not going to do anything about the wall. And when Charles de Gaulle, acting independently once again, was going to bulldoze the wall down, he was reined in by the United States. Now that has been revealed all over Europe. It's a fact of history.
Well, I just don't accept that. I think that's, again, just too far out. Let's leave this for a while here. We seem to have opened a couple of cans of worms.
Certainly.
What about Canada's role under your prime ministership or premiership in the Middle East? What would you support the Arabs or the Israelis or neither?
This is one area in the world where if everything was conducted logically and reasonably, Canada would have very little interest. We are in a very fortunate situation that Canada produces more oil than it consumes, that we are an oil exporting nation. We could be self-sufficient and consequently independent. However, we have a very large, well-organized, vocal Jewish minority here, which has been able to get Canada to do its dirty work for itself, namely once again through this United Nations front, where Canada supplies peacekeeping troops to keep the Arabs away from the Israelis, which in my book anyways means that Canada is guilty of defending crooks who have taken over by military invasion and by terrorism lands which do not belong to them. And I can tell you, I'm not a Canadian-born Canadian. I'm an immigrant to this country. If I was a Canadian by birth, I would fight tooth and nail to remedy it. And should I become Prime Minister of Canada, I can assure you that one of my first acts would be to remove the Canadian troops from peacekeeping duties in the Middle East.
You mean to say you actually believe that a small group of Jews in Canada have been able to twist the arm of Canada to putting it into the Middle East where it has no business? Don't you think Canadian interests and Israel's are one and the same?
No, I don't. I don't. And it's interesting, if you question the power of Canadian Jews, we have had just the war a year ago in the Middle East, Israel's famous Six-Day War, and the demonstrations that took place in the city of Montreal, where unbridled passion ran loose in the streets, where you saw nothing but yarmulkes and Israeli Star of David flags. I counted a full page newspaper photograph, and I saw only one little Canadian flag. All the rest were Israeli flags. In other words, Canadian Jews worship Israel with a vehemence that I only saw displayed in Nazi Germany in the Nuremberg rallies.
Well, that
so I could say that Jewish nationalism is alive and well in the streets of Montreal.
But don't you think that in view of the Holocaust and the Nazi atrocities against the Jews, that Canadians have a responsibility to protect Israel as a homeland for the Jewish people?
If we then become guilty of harboring, aiding and abetting military
adventurism and so on. No, I don't think so at all. Let the Jews defend the Jewish homeland. I want to do good for Canadians. I frankly think that the Jews can look out after themselves.
Well, would you say then that you were pro-Arab?
In this particular issue, I certainly do. I think that the Palestinians are being deprived of a homeland. The right of self-determination is denied them. And as a Canadian Prime Minister, I could not support that now.
Well, does this mean to say that you would drive Canadians into isolationism, but you wouldn't have, you just say, to hell with the rest of the world, we want to get off?
If the rest of the world acted crazily and backed suicidal moves and immoral moves, I would not hesitate for one moment to proclaim Canada a sanctuary and a haven for common sense and decency, yes.
Well, let's put it this way. You would break off or limit Canada's role in the United Nations. You would limit Canada's support of the United States. You would support Red China. You would get out of the Middle East. And what about Europe? Do you you see Canada having any contacts with Europe, or would you just cut off all contact with them too?
No, Canada has a long association with Europe. It is basically a two-way street. Europe sends brains, settlers, manufactured goods to Canada, and Canada in exchange sends over raw materials and the odd invasion force as it did in World War I and World War II.
At least you wouldn't isolate Canada completely. You
no, the role
still
of
listen to Wagner and all those things.
Well, look, no, quite seriously. I gave you a dig at Wagner, and I still think that you read your Marxist textbooks very well. What I am saying to you is that Canada in Europe ought to play the role of a Western ally, but at the same time, Canada ought to stop broadcasting anti-German movies and anti-German, peddling anti-German textbooks and magazine articles and so on, when Canadian soldiers are training with Canadian arms, partly in Canada, together with Canadians in Europe, when Germany, as a NATO partner, has made available to Canada military bases in Germany and so on. So, I think that Canada should get off its high horse of victor of World War II and truly forge an alliance based on mutual interest of the free world against the communist world.
Well, I don't think that the past should be forgotten, and I'm certainly, I wouldn't advocate the past should be forgiven either, because after all, the Germans were responsible for Hitler, they were responsible for the deaths of 6 million, the murder of...
Bunk. More Zionist propaganda.
Well,
number one, the Germans were responsible for Hitler, certainly. There is not a decent German that has ever denied that. But also, the Soviets and the United States were responsible for Stalin and its crimes. You know, that regime's crimes.
There you go again. Back to the old capitalist-communist nexus there.
Well, I do. Because it is, after all, the United States who rescued Stalin from bankruptcy during the famous Kulak uprising and whatever it was, the mass executions, the mass trials, all the intellectuals and all the media circles in the United States knew about that. But yet, you went to bed with the enemy of democracy in order to slay the German dragon. Being a German, I can tell you that to the German people, and to those who fought, it looked very much like two bullies ganging up on somebody who was trying to do good in the world.
Well, that's certainly not the way I heard it, and the history books certainly say otherwise.
Well, your history books, American history books, written by people like Ashley Montagu, whose real name is certainly not Ashley Montagu, and who under the auspices of your United Nations, which you seem to like so much, has written over 133 school textbooks, which means one man's opinion brainwashing practically every student in the world.
Well, he's a noted authority on history, just as Rappaport.
Well, certainly. So was Al Capone.
Well, he made history. He didn't write it. But that's, again, off the subject. Well, let's see now. We seem to have covered most of the world. Well, we've left out Africa. Now, what do you think Canada should do in regard to North Africa?
Well, North Africa? Well, North Africa.
The Arab part.
We could sell Canadian wheat, Canadian technology, in exchange for possibly oil, which we can use on the eastern seashore in Canada here, but it's not really a very important area for Canada to be involved. See, Canada is a vast country. I don't know if the people down south of the border realize that. In this Canada of ours, we are as big as the Soviet Union and have only 20 million people. What the heck do we have to engage in a foreign policy, poke our noses into all kinds of people's affairs, which are no concern of ours?
Well, I guess you could probably monopolize the world trade in ice cubes if you really wanted to get in on it. But let's go a little further south in Africa. What about Black Africa? Don't you see that Canada has, again, as a democracy, the duty to support self-determination for Black people in Africa against the white imperialist?
You know, it's really weird. The Canadians are part of the British Commonwealth, and the British Commonwealth is being booted out all over Africa. You know what I mean? What are we? Using our left hand to kick the right hand or punch the right hand? No, I'll tell you quite frankly. Once again, I may as well give it to you straight. I consider Canada's meddling in African affairs hypocritical and insane. We have no business down there. We have no colonial interests down there. We have very few financial economic interests down there. We ought to keep our noses clean. There's enough trouble in the world that Canada can look into. We don't have to bother about Africa. However, speaking again as a resident of Canada, which is using my taxes to meddle in African affairs, I can tell you, seeing what the commies over here in our press do, and how they write up Southern Africa, Rhodesia, Mozambique, Angola, and so on, I can foresee nothing but trouble. Our religious journals and our religious denominations here, which are part of the World Federation of Churches or whatever, are constantly financing terrorists under the guise of human kindness and stuff like that. What we are seeing are a bunch of wild-eyed pinkos supporting under the guise of self-determination, nothing but Marxist movements in Africa. And if we people of the Western world don't watch out, our NATO ally Portugal and our interests with other Western European nations are going to be severely compromised by the very people whom we support down there under the guise of majority rule. I think that Africa is not ready for independence, that Western Europe has a right to be in Africa by our very right that we actually colonized that planet, gave it roads, railroads, airports, health systems, stable governments and so on. And I think that it is communists in our media, once again, that are misdirecting the direction of foreign policy and of the people's thinking in the Western world.
So you'd actually advocate denial of any Canadian assistance for the black people's struggle for freedom in Africa?
I certainly would. If I were to become Prime Minister of Canada, I would stop the absurdity of lauding our supposed Franco-Canadian involvement with Gabon in places like that, just because these blacks down there know how to read French and read their Marxist textbooks in French doesn't make them French.
Sounds a little like a racist statement there.
Well, are you afraid to be white?
Well, I'm not.
What's the problem with you?
Well, we're not We just don't bring that up. After all, we're human beings, you know. We're not being white or black or... this isn't the important thing.
Well, but, if you want to hear another fresh opinion, I can give you another one. And that is that I think it is absolutely, well, poppycock, to put it mildly, to deny race in history and to deny race in politics.
Well, that's another big subject, and I have my own opinions on that, but I've got one more question here, which is much closer to home, because with your breath of fresh air, so to speak, what would happen to the relations between Canada and the United States?
Boy, now that is a really big subject. I'd like to be brief with you, because I'm having another call, it seems, another line here. Let me just say this, that the United States government establishment, which is military-industrial complex, dominates the destiny of Canada, something fierce, and it is quite often apparent that what is good for General Motors is not necessarily good for the people of Canada. Now, our relations as a people to people are excellent, because basically we dress the same way, we think the same way, we love the same way, and we speak the same way even. But there are differences. And the one difference is that the United States, because of its very power and size, has always global interests. Maybe therefore your questions are always global and mine are more regional. I find that the United States business establishment, for instance, has completely dominated the Canadian political scene, and to the detriment of Canada, may I say. I'll give you a few examples. For instance, we had an aerospace industry in Canada that was second to none. We had produced in this country with German and British scientists some fantastic planes, both commercial planes and jet fighter planes. One of them was the Avro Aero. Now, the Avro Aero was a very powerful and fast jet fighter interceptor, which could have gotten Canada millions and millions of dollars in the export trade. What did we see? A Canadian political party canceling the production contract of the Avro Aero in favor of buying some American junk fighters.
Junk fighters?
No, junk fighters, like junk food, junk music, junk art, and so on. In other words, we bought from the United States Voodoo interceptors.
Yes.
Which were outmoded in the United States, and nobody in the United States Armed Services wanted it. And our Canadian political establishment actually scotched, destroyed these very fast-moving Canadian planes, which had already been test-flown and for which there were orders coming in. And I just wondered what large multinational American corporation greased our political hacks' hands up here. Now, that is one instant where the flower, the pride of Canada's industrial establishment was destroyed, and because it was destroyed, the United States aircraft industry actually very handsomely profited by hiring away over 20,000 top-notch aerospace engineers and so on.
Well, I'm not in favor of the arms industry, as you can understand, and I certainly don't favor the national chauvinist movements in any part of the world. I can agree with you about the United States with its arms industry, and that's a bad thing, and its military-industrial complex, but I certainly can't agree with you that Canada should establish its own military-industrial complex.
No nation that does not produce its own arms will ever be truly free.
It will always be dependent. And if I was to become Prime Minister of Canada, and chances are that, if not this time, some other time, I can assure you that I would encourage a buy Canadian policy produced by Canadians for the use by Canadians.
Hmm. Well, I think you've pretty well covered the ground. All I can say is thank you, but I I hope you don't become the Prime Minister.
Well, all I can say is that I don't have to worry about your vote since you're not a Canadian.
All right. Anyway,
thank you.
Thank you.
Speaking.
Mr. Zundel, my name is John Sanders. I'm a student at Ryerson Collegiate. I'm taking social sciences, and actually at this time in my course I'm required to do a thesis on the political leadership race. I noticed that you're quite public these days on this different matters, and I heard you make what I consider, I must be very frankly, a really stupid, outrageous statement that you feel the users of marijuana and other narcotics should be punished more severely. How can you say that? I don't think you're young enough to probably have tried it or experienced it, and you probably have no backing for that statement.
Well, quite frankly, first of all, as to your using it or me never have used it, you're absolutely right. I wouldn't go near that stuff with a 10-foot pole.
But how can you make a statement about it not people should be punished more severely? If you haven't tried it, how can you...
I can daily see the results. And sometimes when I look at our governments in the Western world, I wonder if I cannot see the results even on the highest government levels. We seem to be run by a bunch of potheads. No, but to answer your question quite seriously, no judge, no jury in a courtroom, in a court of law, all over the world is required to turn themselves into murderers, prostitutes, pimps, arsonists, or any other assorted crooks before they can pass judgment on somebody that is a crook. So that's so far for me never having tried it. Secondly, they are actually being lulled into this dream world where they feel good and feel wonderful, and ultimately it affects their memory, and there is nothing that politicians would like more than a bunch of dreamy-eyed, forgetful voters, because then they could be even more outrageous in dipping their hands in the public till and by almost literally getting away with murder. Now, I know that for a person that likes to indulge once in a while with their girlfriends in a stick of grass or something like that, that this sounds like heresy, and possibly was I 10 years younger and into the smoking of pot scene, I might feel the same way, but nevertheless, just think of what I'm saying, that we have got global problems right now. We have got a raging war going on in Vietnam, we have got unrest in the United States, we have got a problem in Canada with national unity and separation, unemployment, inflation, and things like this, and I'm telling you that a man needs all his wits about him.